Hey everybody, I'm Paul Yeager and welcome into the MTOM Show podcast, a production of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV program. We're going to be talking about economic development when it comes to innovation in agriculture, taking an analog idea and making it digital. We're going to go to Indiana and Purdue University. Dr. Alan Gray is our guest. He runs Dial Ventures. He'll tell us what it is, where he came from, his connection from the south to the center of the country. We'll also kind of figure out a way that maybe you can fit into that if you think that is a place that maybe you should go with your operation. If not, just know that's the landscape. Feedback for me, paul.yeager@iowapbs.org. Now, Dr. Alan Gray. We could talk about dialects all day. Texas is different than Indiana, so do people, can they figure out yet where you're from when you talk to them?
I like to think in all of my career, 23 years at Purdue now, people don't know two things. They're not exactly sure where I'm from, and they're not sure what my politics are. Those are two things I try to maintain as best I can.
As a cloud of mystery, right?
That's right, yeah.
So Texas is where you're from. I think you said north of Dallas?
Yeah, I grew up in a little town called Howe, Texas, just south of the Red River. Sherman, Denison, north of us, about 60 miles north of Dallas.
Yep. Is that a ag background, or did you decide to go on the farm differently?
Yeah, I grew up on a farm, kind of an old McDonald farm, if you will, back when we used to still have those. So wheat and corn, mostly on the crop side of things. Grain sorghum, quite a bit of that. Hogs, cattle. So a number of different things that we did. You know, when I left the farm to go to college, that's when we stopped growing hogs. Had something to do with lost the labor that was cleaning the hog pens, I think. So that's what I remember about that. Family's retired now, though. There's about roughly 300 acres that are owned by that family. My father and my uncle, they continue to run some cow-calf there. They're what's wrong with the cow-calf industry, Paul. They have zero intention of making any money, right? They just want it there to, one, keep themselves out of trouble with their wives, and two, to figure out how to minimize the tax burden.
I understand that, and there's probably more in that. I think I've told the story before of my great-grandfather who used to say, you know, if you want $1 million, what would you do with it? And he says, I'd feed it in cattle until it was gone. He didn't care about the making money part. But so that being said of the history, you went the academic route. Did you ever have an intention of returning back to maybe make old McDonald be new McDonald on your farm?
Well, I did. Yeah, that's a good question. So a couple of things that I thought I would do. First, I thought I'd go back as the veterinarian. And then I took organic chemistry, and that convinced me I probably wasn't going to be a veterinarian. My brother is, by the way, in Sulphur Springs, Texas, so he managed organic chemistry better than I did. I thought I'd go back to the farm, and then my dad reminded me after I'd broken a piece of equipment for the fourth time one summer that it'd probably be a better idea for me to stay in college, which is what I've done. I've stayed there as long as I can now.
I think we had similar fathers. I did the same thing. I could break it, couldn't fix it. That was my issue. Academic, what was the, so organic chemistry doesn't work out. What drew you to economics or the study of innovation?
Yeah, funny question, actually. Boy, you're asking me to reflect back on all of the life adventures here. So I was pretty big in FFA in high school and was an officer at the district level, at the area level. Showed animals, always involved in parliamentary procedure competitions, things like that. And through that process, earned a scholarship. That scholarship paid for most of my undergraduate education, but it needed to be in agriculture. That was the stipulation of the scholarship. But I sort of liked accounting, believe it or not. So I was looking for a way to mix agriculture and accounting when the organic chemistry didn't work out for me. And so the way to do that was to go agricultural economics at Tarleton State University in Stephenville, Texas. And so that's what I did. I went to agricultural economics so that I could study agriculture in a way that still combined with sort of the business school thoughts around accounting. And that's what led me down that agricultural economics path. And then from there, met some folks at Texas A&M while I was working for the experiment station on crop insurance decision-making for farmers, and got connected with some faculty members at Texas A&M who were doing that research. They offered me a position as a researcher at Texas A&M to get my master's degree, and I just got my master's, went on, got my PhD, and now here we are.
Well, it's kind of the way agriculture, though, has gone. Accounting is probably more important to the business side, if not all of the sides of an operation, than maybe repairing equipment. I mean, you have to have a sharp pencil just as much as you have to have a sharp blowtorch.
You know, I think today, modern agriculture in the U.S., particularly Brazil, another place I've spent a lot of time, those two areas are two I think of as sort of really modern agriculture. Look, these are multi-million-dollar agribusiness companies. You don't run those things any longer out of a shoebox with some receipts that you hopefully didn't lose along the way, right? I mean, you know, we got a lot at stake in this industry. There's a lot of opportunity to make a living, to make a good living, to make a profit out of things, but you've got to be a very good business manager to do that. Technically, yes, there are people with skills in certain technical skills, whether that be in agronomy, or it's around animal husbandry, or it's around other technical pieces of the industry that you might bring to it. But the one that's pervasive is, if you can't run a sophisticated multi-million-dollar agribusiness today, you're going to be in trouble. And that includes accounting. For sure.
Exactly. And it sounds like, are there more resources available to allow this to happen than there was before?
Yes, I think so. I think, you know, increasingly you see, for example, what we do here at Purdue now in Dial, you know, there are digital tools that are becoming more and more available. I think over time becoming more effective at what they do to help us in agriculture and in agribusiness broadly. In some ways, we're unique. I always hate to say it that way, Paul. We're a business just like any other business. And people say, well, yeah, but agriculture is different. Well, it is. Why? Because it's personal. Because everybody has to eat. Because it's uncertain on the supply side, and it's uncertain on the demand side. Okay, there's a number of reasons why we might be a little bit different than other industries, but by and large, we're the same as other industries with our specific nuances. What's happened is that the digital space, particularly, that's bringing the tools and technologies to help us be better at managing the business, are just now sort of getting to the point where they begin to understand our nuances so that we can apply those tools and techniques to make us better at decision making. At least that's my perspective.
I kind of led you into what Dial is before saying, what is Dial? It has a name, but give us a background on it.
Yeah, so we're known as Dial Ventures now, but Dial itself was originally a Digital Innovation and Agri-Food Systems Lab. That's a mouthful. And we're famous at Purdue for sort of taking mouthfuls of titles and then scrunching them down to four letters that probably don't mean anything at all. But that's how we got to Dial, Digital Innovation and Agri-Food Systems Lab, shortened to Dial. But then as we continue to develop our concept around what we're going to do in digital innovation, we've moved to this sort of startup studio concept now and added to the name Ventures. So we're Dial Ventures, and we're a startup studio here at Purdue.
And that's still inside the university, or is that one of those we're across the street but yet connected?
Yeah, that's a good question. We're in the Purdue Applied Research Institute. It's a new LLC that Purdue just created about 16, 17 months ago now. It's a place where Purdue has a bit more freedom to do contract types of work, to do things that allow them to be able to do better public-private partnership types of activities, and to do things like we're doing in our venture studio, which is really sort of combining that venture world with startup companies and equity sharing agreements, things like that.
Well, the academic world has, I know the University of Iowa had a president recently that he was charged with make it more like a business, run the university more like a business, and it sounds like Purdue just took it and created a business, but not changed the focus there of the university.
Yeah, I think Paul, if you look at Purdue over the last decade, Mitch Daniels is our president. Comes in, he's from the business world. He has a pretty business-oriented mind to the way we want to use the university. He's always said we want to be the easiest university in the world to do business with. And he meant that, I believe, during all of his tenure, he meant that. And I suspect, I don't want to put words in President Daniels' mouth, but I suspect at times he was frustrated because universities are notoriously difficult to do business with for a number of different reasons, many of which are quite legitimate, but it's difficult to do that. One of the interesting things was Purdue Applied Research Institute was created specifically to say, what else can we do to get away from some of the difficulties associated with doing business with the university? And I think it's been fairly effective so far at being able to do that. We're not the only ones to do this. The Georgia Tech Technical Institute does this sort of stuff. Research Triangle Park and RTI out of North Carolina, they do these sort of things. So Purdue's not unique in its formation of this sort of institute. It's just a better vehicle for certain types of activity you want to perform that is more applied in its nature.
Do you have a specific customer in mind of who you're serving?
For Dial, that's a good question. So Dial serves the industry. So our job in Dial as a startup studio is to create startup companies that will help digitize the ag and food system. Okay, our primary customer for us is the industry itself. So lots of people will say, well, so startups are about disrupting the current industry that's there. And that's true. They do that. What we do is kind of flip it on its head a little bit and say, let's have the industry be involved from the start in the development of these startup companies, recognizing that most of our colleagues in the industry struggle, frankly, to do much that's disruptive innovation. A simple example, Syngenta will do a very good job of creating new chemistries to help manage crop protection issues at the farm level. That's innovation. That's not disruption. Disruption is how well can Syngenta do at disrupting the industry's approach to ESG through digital software. Well, it's not the core. They don't. But it might very well have a huge impact on their business long term, and they worry about it and they're paying attention to it. So we're trying to be the partner of the industry that says, let us do the disruptive work for you. And instead of you being disrupted in that process, you're learning right along beside us as we create these disruptive engines, and you're an investor. So you're invested in these startup companies, and as they grow and mature, you're going along with them. You understand what's happening, and if they become the right business for you, you can acquire them, right? And there now you're not being disrupted anymore. You're part of that disruption, which Paul, we need. I mean, I think McKinsey's the one who did the study of 22 industries, food and agriculture is number 22 out of 22 with respect to digitization of its industry. And this is the problem we want to solve. And our partners aren't well suited to do that. The food and agribusiness industry is very good at what it does. It's also by and large analog. So how do you turn it into a digital system and make it more efficient, more effective, more transparent, more traceable? All of the pieces of the puzzle that we hear the buzz around that we want to try to solve, where digital has an opportunity to solve that. But that's what we're trying to do. So who is our customer? Our primary customer is the industry.
Well, I think of the farmer who does so much with a cell phone. Are they a help to you when they've already adapted more of that digital sense of, I can control things remotely, or I have spreadsheets? I mean, that's how I think of digital, and I think a lot of people think of digital. Am I accurate in my thinking of what digital means, or am I missing the lesson?
So I think those are the starts to digital. Those are some tools that are available to help us, right? Spreadsheets are they're digital, but they're not connected.
Got
right?
it.
So the problem is that lots of people have spreadsheets, which means they have data that's orphaned in different categories of the world, and they're not connected to each other in ways that actually create efficiency, effectiveness, traceability, transparency, those sorts of things, right? So we have some enabling tools there, but our ability to connect that system is still pretty poor, frankly. If you talk with farmers like we do, we spend all day every day talking with farmers and others across the industry. They'll tell you their number one challenge is the interoperability of data. And it's two ways. It's the data that was within my operation that I can't even get those connected well to learn from it and utilize that to help me get better. And then that data connection across partners is almost non-existent. And so when you can't get all of that data and information connected, you can't now really employ effectively things like where I think digitization is artificial intelligence, machine learning, the things that are not just I have data, but they're things that are taking that data and analyzing it and helping us do the jobs we're already doing in a more efficient, effective manner. And for the most part, where farmers are helping us is helping us identify what the jobs to be done are that they can't get done very well because they have these problems with digitization still, right? And so what they'll tell you is, I have more than enough data. I do not, Alan, please don't create another company to create more data. By the way, don't create another company to create another job for me to do either. How about if we just take the data I have, the jobs I'm trying to get done, and make those more efficient and effective? And whether I'm talking about that at the farm level, which we work on, Paul, or I'm talking about that at the ag retailer level, we're working on that, or we're talking about it at the food manufacturer level, any one of those areas across that system, we're having similar conversations with similar groups around the same challenges. Get plenty of data, lots of jobs to do, can't get those jobs more efficient from the data we have yet. How do you help us with that?
Alan, there are companies that have offered services and to be a one-stop shop. However, there becomes a pushback of whose data is it and why do you need to look at it to help? Because that's how it's pitched of, we can be your one-stop shop for everything. And then there's people who are like, oh, I don't want to give that data up. Where's the debate that you have of trying to be efficient, but also maintain some ownership of data?
Yeah. So always a sticky issue. First thing you want to do is make sure that this is a trust system, and we know this. Our industry is a relationship-built system, so the first place you want to start is from building a relationship, okay, and understanding how to build that trust with your customer base. And then from there, the next thing you have to do is show the benefits associated with sharing the data. My take is this. Any customer will share the data with you if they believe the benefits they get are going to outweigh the costs and or the risks of sharing that data. Right? So a couple of things that we want to do with that. First of all, we want a system that clearly shows we're going to help you do the jobs you're currently doing easier. Benefit first. Second of all, we're going to make sure you know you have control of what we do or don't do with that data. You are in control of it, right? Now, in the end, Paul, we want to create the most benefit we can, and that probably means we need your data to do it. But we'll leave you in control of that, and we'll focus on here's the benefits you get from sharing it, right? That's our approach to it, is to maintain trust. Make sure folks know that's what we're trying to do. So I'll give you an example of an idea that we're working on. Farmers are constantly working to try to improve their relationships with their landowners. And we've seen a number of different things happen in that space. You see people doing newsletters. They put together financials for each year for the farm or whatever to talk with their landowners about, here's what I'm doing for your land. Idea being, it shouldn't always be about how much do I pay in cash rent, but maybe there's other benefits that come along with this. Well, we're trying to help create a digital system that be like a customer relationship management system. And it would track for every farm that a farmer's renting from a landowner, it would track every activity that farmer is doing on that farm. whether that be spraying, mowing the ditches, cover crops, whatever the case may be. The farmer chooses those things that they're going to collect, right? And it's in the cloud, but it's in their name. And then they decide what parts of that they want to share or don't share, okay? Now, what we can do with that data is within that data in the cloud, it's still your data. We're, all we're going to do with it is we'll run a piece of software behind it that, for example, creates a custom newsletter from the data that you put up there. That custom newsletter is created so that you can share it with your landowner. We'll give you the right. Do you want to share raw data with your landowner, only certain parts of it? Do you want to create a dashboard that your landowner can look at the dashboard, but they can't get to the data? Right? We'll help create that in a way that makes sense for you. Then, over time, we see that data being collected. Well, that historical set of data, that's activity you've performed on that farming operation, is a valuable data set. What could we do with that? We could, for example, create an NFT. What is that? That's a digital signature of that data set. Now you own it, and it is your data with your signature on it that's immutable. It can't be changed. Okay. I could envision a future where you say, General Mills, would you like to rent this NFT from me for a period of time to show that you're investing in agriculture in places where ESG is a primary feature, and I have the data to back it up to show you what we've been doing that's very environmentally, socially, and governance sustainable, right? Okay, now we've created value with that data, and that's what we're trying to do here. Say, that's your data, Mr. Farmer, and by the way, you can choose to put it in that NFT and exchange it. And we'll help you with the exchange with people who might want to buy it. Or you can say, this is my data and I don't want to share it at all. That's up to you. Our job is to create benefits that you say, I want to share the data because it's valuable to me. That's a long answer for you to say, let's stay away from the legal, who owns it, who doesn't own it. Look, the person who creates the data owns the data. The question is it valuable when it sits there by itself? My view is probably not. But it's on us as a startup company to say, here's how we can create value from your data. Do you want to share it or not?
Right. And I think of, yes, the landowner to renter relationship is one. You also said sustainability in there. There's an opportunity that agriculture as an industry as a whole could use data to therefore to fight against a perceived, you are polluting all of our water, you're doing things to the land, you're doing all of, there's the data to say, no, we're not. This is what is coming off of this waterway at this moment, if you want to say it's runoff or water or soil or however it is, that would be able to then tell the story in a way. Am I reading right what you're saying?
Yeah, these are the things that I think that we could do to be, if we digitize our farming practices, we can have the data to prove these sorts of things. And actually, Paul, I think it's more important to think of it from this perspective. So a couple of organizations we've been working with, one is a food processor, a potato processor. I can be more specific, potato processor. Well, that potato processor has a board of directors. They're publicly traded. ESG matters. They got to have an ESG report. Turns out, where does most of the data for that potato processor come from? From the producers. The farm is the one creating the most valuable data sets for food industry, for ESG. That we are the data creators at the production agriculture level. But we're not digitizing that stuff very well and getting it into a package that can show real impacts, that can do a continuous improvement over time framework to show this is what's happening in this farming operation. Unfortunately, I feel like too much of the conversation early on headed down the regulatory path without understanding the differentiation opportunities that are there to be able to market our differential that we do at the farm level, right? A long time pet peeve of mine, Paul, are getting me off subject a little bit, but is marketing in production agriculture is the four P's, price, 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 and price. And I think it's the dumbest thing we've ever done. Why can't a farming operation market who it is, what it does, and price multiple sets of products, including data in its processes? And that's when you start thinking about marketing, is actually, it's product, price, place, and promotion. And it's all four of those things together creates a strategy that creates real value. And I think we've just, what we've done is said, if it's not about price, then everything else is about regulation. And that's not true. There are real opportunities here to position yourself to create real value in the marketplace by the data you collect and the way in which you present it.
Well, I think of production style agriculture, corn and soybeans, that fits in that price column more than changing the four P's to be something different. I think of a farm that has maybe only 100 acres and has completely altered what they do with that acreage and how they market a homegrown product or grass-fed beef or a specialty this or that sounds more like the marketing. So from what you're saying, it sounds like there's more opportunity for maybe a smaller producer to make a niche with this technology and digitization of agriculture. Did I get the lesson?
No, I don't think that's true, Paul. I think it's both. I mean, certainly smaller farms, and they've been doing this for a while, whether we're talking about farmer markets or you know, creating special relationships with regional grocery stores, whatever the case, U-Picks, right, and come to the farm. There's a number of those different things, and certainly there's a set of folks out there that have been quite successful at being able to market themselves in terms of that sort of consumer connection to the farm. There's that role. There's certainly a role to play there. But I think it happens in Broadacre. I think it can happen in Broadacre, and it should happen in Broadacre, right? And in a lot of ways, it already does, but people don't think about it that way, right? For example, the landowner is a customer of a Broadacre crop farmer. Broadacre crop farmer's primary job, if you think about it, because they, by and large, they lease 60% or more of their land these days. They're basically a land manager for a customer called a landowner. There's plenty of marketing to be done in that space for sure, right? And that creates a real benefit to me if I'm good at it. If I'm good at managing that land and I'm good at communicating how well I'm managing that land, that makes for a much more preferred approach. And increasingly now, I believe that same Broadacre crop has opportunities to market what they do to Microsoft, to AWS, to Kroger, to McDonald's, because those folks want to show for their investors that, listen, we're investing in the things that are better for our planet. We have to show that. So today, I don't like getting into this market too much because it's a rabbit hole, but carbon, I mean, today it's carbon sequestration, right?
Yeah.
So your ability to market what you do, collect the data, and prove what you do with respect to carbon sequestration is an opportunity to create value. Is it of high value? I don't think so. Is it a long-term market? I'm doubtful about that. But I do think it's a microcosm of the things that we do in agriculture beyond I grow corn and soybeans. Well, yes, you grow corn and soybeans. You protect soil health. You protect water quality. You protect air quality. You maintain a diverse set of organisms in your soil. There's just a number of different things that are increasingly important to consumers and board members of these publicly traded companies that we produce in production agriculture. Well, let's collect that stuff, market it effectively, and create value from them.
Well, you mentioned the value side of this discussion. That's fascinating to me because if I'm a producer or if I hold the crop, the commodity, whenever I have more than one person going after that crop, I usually win. A little competition helps me get a better price. And if I have other people after what I'm producing, as a producer, I'm going to win. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. No doubt about that. The more you have, but I would argue this, Paul, it's not just about the corn and the soybeans and the buyers on that side. Certainly the more buyers I have, the better off I'm going to be. But what about the other products I'm producing?
Yeah.
If I have multiple buyers for those other products. And this is what we're kind of trying to challenge the industry to say, if we digitize, we'll create new digital products. What does it look like to produce digital products? A farmer is a producer. If they're producing digital products, what do those look like and who are the customers for those and how do those create value? That's another way for us to think about the value side of that equation. And again, it's this, how do you get past the mentality, well, it's my data and I own it, Yeah, okay. Well, it's your data. You own it. You produced it. How about if you create value from it or extract value, not create value, extract value from it. It's your data. How do you extract value from it? That's the way I would want to think about it.
Yeah, it's like you can have all the Beanie Babies from the 1990s, but if you've never sold them, they don't do you any good.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, just sitting on a cache of that. How do you convince someone? Because I can think of plenty of skeptical producers who, it might not be about the data. They just resist a lot of, lack of a better term, a big brother effect. And that, and like you said, I think you already answered it earlier. You talk about trust. Is that the hardest sales job in trying to convince someone to participate?
I think there's two avenues I would pursue on that, Paul. One is about trust and relationships, and my view is the coast based startup companies have struggled with this. I have the whiz bang technology to solve all of agriculture's problems. Just let me do it, and they don't understand the industry. They don't understand the nature of relationships. The fact that people go to church with each other on Sundays. Yes, they compete they compete at times. Maybe they're competing for land, but they also will help each other harvest crops when somebody's sick. Right? It's not what the East Coast or the West Coast thinks of as competition. It's a very competitive environment in agriculture for sure, but it's a unique sort of relationship trust built system, and where they've struggled is they have not understood that well, in my judgment, to understand you've got to start from building those relationships, and that's how you'll get adoption. Now, having said that, but here's my other angle on that. Adoption in agriculture of technology is often difficult, right? Particularly in this space where it's a digital and data, it's not, hey, adopt this seed or adopt this crop protection. We've gotten used to that adoption of technology over time, or adopt this physical piece of equipment, right? That part is common in agriculture. This is a space that's uncommon. So I think that producers are naturally hesitant. My view of that and the way we think about that in Dial is that our startup companies probably aren't going to be that successful if their go-to-market strategy is let's go knock on farmers' doors and have them adopt. Mm. We need partners. This is why our agribusiness partners are so important. So we think about ag retail. We think about grain companies. We think about those companies that already have those relationships with these farmers and saying, how do we help you do your job better and in the process help the farmer do his job better, right? Let me give you an example. A company we're just about to start. We're almost launching this company within a week or two. It's a company focused on helping farmers manage the H-2A migrant labor system. Mm. So it's common on the coasts, right? Common in the South. It's coming to the Midwest because labor is such a major problem.
It's there in some places, yeah.
Well, H-2A labor is a gigantic mess. It's an unbelievably complicated system. We don't have time to get into it today, but it's a very complicated system that involves the government and it involves a number of different players along the channel. And we believe there's a real a software solution that's going to help make that easier. Think TurboTax for H-2A labor. Think that way, right? The folks that are really building this hate it when I say that because I'm oversimplifying it. But in my simple mind, I'm like, okay, think TurboTax for H-2A labor. Look, we could have created this company and said, let's go door to door to every farmer we can find who needs H-2A labor and see if they'll adopt our system. Okay, we'd be forever trying to make any impact with that. And every sell is a tough sell. But you find out, actually, there are visa processors that process these visas. There's probably only about 25 of them. They process all of them. And they have relationships with the farmer or the farm labor company. That's an important relationship. And they struggle with the exact same problems that the farmers struggle. Well, let's make their job easier. And in the process of making their job easier, we're going to make the farmer's job easier in this same process. And now we're adopting technology in a way that's not so hard to get it adopted faster. And this is again, relationship building. We went to the farmers. We understood their problems. They started telling us how they get around it. Now they introduce us to the visa processor. We start talking to the visa processor. They tell us And now we've found a way to say, hey, wait a minute, we trust you guys. You seem to be really in tune with what our real challenge is and how to help us get that problem done, not, hey, I've got a solution for you, everybody just adopt my hammer.
Right. And any time that you can cut help in a day, half a day on H2A labor is huge, because whether it is the labor used in the daily dairy barn or in picking raspberries, blueberries, whatever the labor is, days matter. And if you can help the efficiencies, it sounds like it's that would be a successful thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's what we're trying to do.
All right, real quick, let's close with this, Dr. Gray. Economic headwinds overall facing agriculture here in the next 6 months. What do you see?
You know, I think we've still got supply chain disruption challenges that, in some ways you get tired of hearing that. Everything today is blamed on supply chains. That's the way you get out of it, is say everything is based on supply chains. I see those supply chains getting better. Russia, Ukraine notwithstanding, but, you know, we're now seeing shiploads of wheat coming out of there. I see that, even if it's herky-jerky and a little bit slow, even that's going to start to get better. So what do you see? Well, I mean, if I'm looking at the tea leaves, I always say predictions are dangerous, but I'll give it a shot. I suspect commodity prices are face headwinds. And then the question is, well, what happens to our inputs? They'll come down, but they usually don't come down as fast. So pretty good year economically. Overall, it depends on where you are, what kind of weather situations you had, which particular commodities you were in. But there could be some pretty good year. This could be a pretty good year. Actually, 21 wasn't bad. I think 22 could be a pretty good year. The other turn on that is probably coming. 23 and 24, you want to think about that, you know, the commodity side is going to turn down. The inputs will come with it, but it takes time, particularly, you know, you think about fertilizers. They typically don't come down as fast. So you end up in this sort of negative territory for a little bit as the systems adjust to each other. So I see those as the major headwinds, as we're probably coming off of a major disruption cycle that likely took us way up, and then it's going to bring us right back down where we probably need to be. Everybody doesn't like to hear that, but farmers will tell you too. Listen, there's no better way to destroy a market than $8 corn. That'll destroy a market in a hurry, because, you know, people start looking for alternatives quickly. And if you're in the fertilizer market, the same thing. Hey, there's nothing that destroys a fertilizer market worse than $1,800 a ton nitrogen, because people start looking for alternatives for nitrogen. And that makes a big difference for you. So I think most everybody would rather see those things come back into some normal pricing range. But the adjustment periods are always difficult.
We always find a way. We have to get innovative. And that's what we're talking about today. Dr. Alan Gray, thank you so very much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.
Feedback for the program, or me, markettomarket@iowapbs.org is the email address you should use. We'll see you next Tuesday for another episode of the MTOM Show podcast.